I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There have been more confrontations between supporters and protesters at Donald Trump rallies in recent days, including a full-out brawl in Chicago last Friday until the event was canceled. Trump has been blamed by the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates for encouraging conflict, even violence. He said he might pay the legal fees for John McGraw, who punched protester Rakeem Jones as he was being escorted from a rally in North Carolina. McGraw has been charged with assault and disorderly conduct. Here's Donald Trump at a campaign event in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, last month before the caucuses.
To have a crowd like this on our final day, can you believe it? This is the day. This is the day we take our country back. Remember that. This is the day we take our country back. So I got a little notice, in case you see, the security guys. We have wonderful security guys. They said, Mr. Trump, there may be somebody with tomatoes in the audience. So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise. I promise.
Ashley Parker has been covering Donald Trump for The New York Times, has witnessed these confrontations and talked with both protesters and Donald Trump supporters. And Ashley Parker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Robert Mackey, senior writer at the online publication The Intercept, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. And Robert Mackey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be with you.
And rounding out our conversation is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a Boston College history professor, author of a new history of the Republican Party called To Make Men Free. And Heather Cox Richardson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
Actually, let me begin with you. I know you covered Jeb Bush in his bid for the White House. Now you're covering Donald Trump. Could there be more two opposite candidates?
Probably not. I mean, it definitely felt going from Jeb. I went to Donald Trump shortly thereafter a couple days, and it felt, you know, like a very jarring, not in a good way or bad way, but just jarring to the system.
How does a Donald Trump rally begin, even before the candidate himself arrives?
Well, one thing that the first time I heard it struck me as very interesting, although then I talked to the other reporters, and this has been going on for a while, is either a staffer stands up or they play an announcement, sort of like what you would hear on an airline safety video that says, you know, this is a private event paid for by Donald Trump. We have areas for protesters outside the event. Some people like to take advantage of Mr. Trump's generosity, but it basically at its core says, you know, if you see a protester, do not touch or harm the protester. This is a peaceful rally. Please begin chanting, point at their, you know, point your sign, wave your sign, point at them so the local law enforcement can find them and begin chanting Trump, Trump, Trump. And largely the crowds, they sort of, until recently, they sort of tittered. It seems kind of funny, and you don't expect that at a political rally. But then when protests break out, people largely follow that, and they do chant Trump, 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 and point at the protester and help law enforcement sort of get to them quickly.
And how do protesters get into a Donald Trump rally, especially if they have signs or they're wearing T-shirts or things like that?
I mean, I think it's harder with signs and if you're wearing T-shirts. And when I talk to some of the protesters for various stories I've written, they've said, you know, this was one protest in Iowa when it was chilly. And they said, you know, they were all wearing shirts, but they hid their shirts either in the back of their pants or the, you know, under layers of jackets and sweatshirts. And so especially now, it is harder. And security is on the lookout for that. They're on the lookout for people in matching clothes. They're on the lookout for big groups of people, people with signs. So a lot of people don't necessarily make it in.
Are they also looking out for minorities?
It's a tricky question, right? Because they've never told me that, and I think they would deny it. But I have talked to protesters who were minorities who felt like they were singled out and sometimes not let in, or sometimes let in, but eyed warily, who were sort of groups of young people, groups of minorities, so sort of up in the air.
You wrote recently, to witness the crowd turn on the protesters in its midst is to watch a feverish body bucking and writhing as it tries to eject an invading virus. Just how dangerous are these kinds of confrontations?
You know, it really depends. And some of the events I've at and what I wrote about, you know, feeling a little unsafe for the first time in New Orleans, is they just sort of teeter on the edge, right? So sometimes he doesn't, recently sometimes he has really had no protesters at all. And he'll even say, can we get a protester? Is there a disruptor in the crowd? Because he likes to say that the dishonest, despicable media will only turn their cameras to show his huge crowds when there's a protester. But when there is a protester, and, you know, especially often at night rallies, especially in warm places, you know, it'll be a constant stream of disruptions, and tensions are very high. The crowd immediately turns hostile and is angry that they're disrupting, and a lot of the protesters are angry, too. They come with their passions high, and they don't necessarily just walk, you know, peacefully out. They'll shout things, and they'll make gestures, and so it just often feels that if the wrong person is shoved or, you know, inadvertently jostled or, you know, the wrong insult hurled the wrong way, everything could kind of just explode into a mosh pit. Although the only time we've really seen that was obviously Chicago.
Exactly. Let me get our other two guests in the conversation, Robert Mackey and Heather Cox Richardson. Robert, let me begin with you. What do you think is happening at these Donald Trump rallies?
Well, I do something a little different than Ashley. I'm studying, for the most part, the social media documentation of the rallies and the way that things filter through on the internet. And something that seems to chime with what she's saying from firsthand experience is that there's an idea that basically the energy of the Trump rally seems to depend on constant interruption from protesters. It's almost as if he's saying to his audience, you know, our culture is under threat. Our way of life is under threat from these invaders. He talks about immigrants as invaders, but also there's a cultural war obviously going on, and there's obviously a racial dimension to that. And I think that it seems like, and I've seen a lot of reporting about this from people who are at rallies, and you can see it happening on videos, that there's an energy to the sort of performance of Donald Trump that depends on constant interruption. I was thinking at one stage that it's almost like watching an insult comic who needs hecklers to feed off. Although in this case, obviously, it's at a much more dangerous, potentially dangerous level than that.
And he has blamed, I don't think there's any evidence so far, Robert, blamed Bernie Sanders supporters for, or even the candidate himself for sending people to his rallies.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the, you know, the conspiratorial version of this story would be that there is no genuine protest against someone as obviously popular as Donald Trump, but it all has to be ginned up or paid for. In my previous work, I studied a lot of these sort of rallies and protests in the Middle East.
Right.
And that was a constant theme of authoritarian figures that, of course, all demonstrations have to be paid for by outside agitators. And it's strange to see echoes of that here in the United States.
Heather, you're our historian for the hour. Have we been here before?
We have been here before, but the way we got here with Donald Trump actually has really interesting parallels to our past. I mean, one of the things that both Ashley and Robert have picked up and are talking about is that Trump has mobilized a group of people who really started in the 1950s, the movement conservatives, who spun a tale that somehow they were the only good Americans who were holding the line against secular America, against a world in which the government had been captured by communists and minorities. And that language at first was fringe language and gradually took over the Republican Party, really beginning with Ronald Reagan and then moving forward into George W. Bush. And now we've got Trump. And it does depend on there being somebody attacking you. And what is interesting about that is, of course, this became so deeply ingrained in American culture. It, in fact, is the story at the heart of Star Wars in 1977. But what's interesting about that is that it has explicit parallels in a number of places. But just this morning, I was reading actually some of the material that is coming out on Trump. And what it looks like to me more than anything right now is Jefferson Davis, who, in fact, had to ride the language of the South in the 1850s, that somehow the North was impeding on the South, that it was going to destroy slavery, that it was going to wipe out the Southern economy and political system. And, of course, Lincoln is up there saying, of course I'm not going to do that. I just want you to stop intruding on us. And what happens is the more the propaganda builds in the 1850s and leading up to the election of 1860, and the more people like Jefferson Davis, who's only one of the many fire eaters, as they were called, the more they ride that, the more they get into trouble when, in fact, Lincoln does get elected, and all of a sudden they've got an entire slew of really angry people who really believe that their lives and their country and their livelihood is at stake. And once they've done that, they almost have no choice but to go the next step or else lose all of their political power. And that, in fact, is, of course, what leads to Jefferson Davis agreeing to fire on Fort Sumter.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Ashley Parker. And I'm looking at a piece that you wrote recently about interviewing some of the both protesters and supporters at a Donald Trump rally. And what do they tell you? And there seem to be some similar complaints, I have to say, not about the candidate, but about their country. When you talk to a Donald Trump supporter, what do they tell you?
Yeah, what's interesting about both supporters and protesters is in very different ways, they are often coming sort of from the same place and using the language of disenfranchisement. So if you talk to a Donald Trump supporter, right, they feel like they've been treated badly or unfairly by government, by the people in Washington, by the big banks. A lot of them were hit hard by the recession, and now they have this chosen candidate, Donald Trump, and they sort of feel that they're getting treated badly again, right? They see Mitt Romney coming out, and they see the Republican Party sort of elders trying to take this nomination away from him, which, you know, by state victories and by delegate math, looks like he's the leader. And they see these protesters as interrupting his rallies and not letting him speak and taking away, you know, Mr. Trump's First Amendment rights, and they're really upset. And then when you talk to the protesters, they also feel disenfranchised. They feel like they can't, like the supporters, they came to this country or they live in this country, depending on who you're talking to,
sure,
you know, with a sense of the exact same thing the supporters say, that, you know, if you work hard and you play by the rules, you can support your family and have a good life. And then they hear this language and they say, you know, I don't recognize this community. This is the town I've lived in for, you know, 20 years or 30 years, and they're turning on me, and this language is frightening. So they're sort of experiencing the same thing, but in very different ways.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, Ashley, I mean, is it frightening for you to cover a Donald Trump rally?
It's not frightening, but there is a sense that there have been some rallies where things have gotten very tense and very heated, and I think the reporters there, as I assume the attendees there and, you know, Donald Trump's security detail, are just sort of aware of, you know, one thing going wrong and the whole place could kind of turn into a mosh pit. And so I think that's something you're aware of as a reporter, especially because we're penned in. We're in the middle of these huge rooms, and he uses us, you know, like a showman, as a foil, right?
Sure.
The despicable media, the disgusting media, which is fine. The media is used to being trashed by all sorts of politicians. It's a good gimmick. But it's something to be aware of if, you know, fights suddenly break out.
Well, Ashley Parker, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times. We have to say goodbye to you. We will continue with our other two guests. And Ashley Parker, a New York Times reporter, and she has been covering Donald Trump rallies. And Ashley, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we will carry on our conversation with Robert Mackey and Heather Cox Richardson, talking about what's been happening at Donald Trump rallies, what the candidate himself has said, and whether his language, his words, his actions have fomented some of the confrontations and violence that we've seen in the last week or so. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Let me play another clip. This is Donald Trump at a rally last week in St. Louis. He's lamenting that there are no consequences for protesters anymore in the United States.
Part of the problem and part of the reason it takes so long is nobody wants to hurt each other anymore, right? And they're being politically correct the way they take them out. So it takes a little bit longer. And honestly, protesters, they realize it. They realize that there are no consequences to protesting anymore. There used to be consequences. There are none anymore. So that's it. All right. Thank you very much.
Continuing our conversation with Robert Mackey, a senior writer at the online publication The Intercept. He previously worked as a reporter and a columnist for The New York Times. He anchored the newspaper's Breaking News blog and wrote a news analysis column. Heather Cox Richardson, also with us as well, a Boston College history professor, in fact, wrote a book called To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And to join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Robert, let me go back to you. I'm looking at a piece that you had recently. Trump not concerned his rallies are not violent enough. Picking up on that clip that we just played and what you have in this piece that you wrote, are you saying that Donald Trump invites and wants violence at his rallies?
Yes, I think that's indisputable. He, what I looked at is that clip and others where Trump is sort of lamenting that the way the protesters are being ejected from his rallies didn't do enough to discourage them through physical violence. And, you know, you play the other clip of him encouraging people to, you know, quote, knock the crap out of protesters. But he also has a constant theme where he laments the good old days when protesters, he said, used to be carried out on stretchers. And what I did was to try and think about and look into what good old days he was talking about. I mean, I think in one way it seemed like maybe he's talking about the Wild West, but he seems to speak about it in a way that he and his audience, these are days that they might recall. So looking at it a little more closely, it occurred to me that perhaps during the first term of Richard Nixon, when there were a lot of anti-war protests and there were clashes, including here in New York City, a famous incident that was known as the Hard Hat Riot, when construction workers were encouraged to beat up anti-war student protesters just a few days after the Kent State shootings. And I wondered if that might be the period he was hoping to return us to. It's an open question because I think no one has actually asked him what he's exactly pining for. But it's interesting that it's a repeated theme, that this used to be the way that things were done, and that was better.
Well, and as you described, this was sort of an all-out battle of construction workers breaking up a student anti-war rally or demonstration in Wall Street. People were hurt. And then the construction workers were actually feted at Richard Nixon's White House.
That's right. It's a sort of it's a moment in New York City history that I think that if you think about the time frame of his life and career, Donald Trump graduated from the Wharton Business School in 1968 and was back working with his father in real estate here in New York. So those construction workers who were working partly on the World Trade Center, the original World Trade Center, were encouraged by their unions. It came out later that they were even given bonuses to go essentially beat up the kids thought of as hippies. So it's a moment where this encouragement to violence actually did take place and resulted in dozens of people being hospitalized. They're quite dramatic photos from the time of basically kids being beaten up by guys in hard hats.
Heather, let me go back to you. And you talked about Jefferson Davis talking about the 19th century. I'd like to talk about the Chicago Convention of 1968. We know that this rally was called off last Friday, but it did get us all thinking about what happened in Chicago in 1968. Are there parallels, or are we talking about, I guess, two different worlds in a way?
No, I don't think so, and I want to pick up something that Ashley was talking about, that what really goes on when Americans riot in terms of politics, and most of our riots do ultimately have a political underpinning to them for reasons that are interesting to America, but in every case when people riot over politics or even go to war over politics in America, it is a result of believing that somehow the government is privileging somebody who doesn't deserve it, that the good guys are being put upon by the bad guys, if you will. It's a very stark way to look at the world, and it comes in part from the way that we instituted national taxation, so that in America, the idea of opening up the suffrage to people of color, to women, to immigrants, comes with the idea that somehow if you let certain people vote, they will vote to redistribute wealth from hardworking taxpayers who are sort of defined as white in this scenario to minorities, to women, to people who are lazy and simply want a handout. And that idea that somehow the body politic is being corrupted, that the government is being corrupted by a special interest, lies at the heart of most of our major riots, not only Democrats in 68, and yes, I think we're looking at something very like that this summer, but you can go right down the list. Many of the race riots after World Wars I and World War II come from the idea that somehow the government has privileged African Americans by providing housing for them, for example, so they could work in Detroit in 1934 was a big riot. Even all the way back, you know, to the original Tea Party, the idea that somehow the government is messing with us, and however you define us, is at the heart of these riots. And, of course, you can be on either side of that. And what these do is that they bring up the idea that somehow the government is unequal, that it's not doing what it should do. And it brings attention to a perceived inequality in American society that then works out over the next several years.
I'm trying to think, though, of a modern-day candidate that has used the kind of language that Donald Trump has used, and as I said in my introduction, who has been criticized and in many cases repudiated by members of his own party, Democrats as well. But have we seen, Heather, a candidate that sort of invites, talks about punching people and inviting people to sort of pounce on other people?
Well, the obvious comparison is somebody like Father Coughlin in the 1930s or Huey Long, or more recently George Wallace, especially in 64. So we do see it, but the point that I think is really important to remember is that the idea somehow that we have this narrative that the government is being taken away, that that's how we talk about politics when they don't go the way we want, that it's being taken away from us. It almost requires you to fight in order to be a good American. And that the many fringe candidates have done that over the years, and they're fringe candidates so that none of us even remember their names. I could start listing them off and you wouldn't be interested. But Donald Trump is the first person who is at the leading edge of a major political party to do it. That's what's different about this minute versus somebody like George Wallace, who was repudiated by leading Democrats, or like Father Coughlin, who was also repudiated. You know, these were fringe candidates. Donald Trump is the first one to take this into a major political party since, really, at least since Andrew Jackson in the 1830s.
Robert, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
I would say the other thing that's interesting now, the modern part of this phenomenon that wasn't possible before, is the ubiquity of live television coverage on cable news of all of these rallies means that Trump doesn't really need to even spend money on political advertising, which previously everyone thought of as the way to get elected. And he can say anything, and it's popular with audiences across the political spectrum for different reasons. It feeds the prejudices of people who support him, and it annoys and upsets people who oppose him in a way that it's almost like scratching an itch. They want to watch it. Well, so you have that, and then the other part is also that he has such a large social media presence. He essentially has his own broadcast platform on Twitter where he can share completely false, crazy things or any of his views, and they get amplified and passed along through the culture.
And Robert, do you think he's right when he says, if there are not protests or if I don't say all these things, I will not get the kind of coverage that I'm getting from the media, broadly speaking?
Well, I don't think that's actually accurate. He got an enormous amount of coverage starting last summer when there was almost no protest at all at his rallies or even at any of his events. It was a very small number of protesters. And it seems like the other thing that's happening that's interesting is that there's this idea, you know, the announcement before the start of the rally that this is a private event, that Mr. Trump has rented this hall wherever it is, and that essentially no one has the right to disagree with him and come there. But then these things are all broadcast on national television. And they're part of a public debate over who should be the next president of the country. Mm. So I think it's a extremely confusing. It's even there's legal uncertainty about what rights a candidate does have to eject people just for disagreeing or perhaps to profile people for their race or ethnic background. So there's a way in which you can see that the protesters feel their point of view in Chicago, I think, was as Trump complains about his First Amendment rights, which, of course, are not in danger if the government isn't stopping him from speaking. The protesters feel like part of the national conversation is being dominated by someone who wants a kind of unfiltered forum to vent hateful and incendiary views.
Well, let me just quickly, excuse me, reintroduce you. That's Robert Mackey. He's a senior writer at the online publication The Intercept. Also with us, Heather Cox Richardson, a history professor at Boston College, wrote a book called To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And yes, we are focusing on a number of the protests and confrontations at Donald Trump rallies in the last week or so. It has raised a whole host of questions about the candidate's comments himself, also what's been happening inside some of these venues. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think. Heather, this does raise an interesting question about free speech and the abridgment of free speech. Of course, that has to do with government abridgment. But I think Robert raises a really interesting question about whether these are private events that Donald Trump is holding or whether they are public events because he is running for the highest office in the land.
Yes, and this is a really interesting gray area, as Robert points out. And how it's going to play out is obviously unclear, but one of the things that again, Trump is playing is the idea that these are private events, and theoretically you can do whatever you want on private property, right? I mean, within limits. But it is, in fact, a national public conversation. And this is actually a really kind of a touchstone moment in the pattern that America has taken since the 1980s, and that is, of course, we have privatized many services that previously were considered part of sort of the public good that the government supported and we supported through our tax dollars. And that's actually been something that I've been watching for a long time, because that's, you know, what happens if, for example, you turn over the roads to a private entity? Do they get to decide who rides on those? Or sidewalks. The reason we had so many riots on sidewalks for so many years through the 19th and early 20th centuries is because sidewalks were half owned by the person who had the storefront on them and half owned by the municipality. So store owners would say, I don't want African Americans walking on the sidewalk in front of my building. Now we've got somebody having taken that into the political arena. This is his private run for the White House, and of course that's not what the government's supposed to be, and yet a lot of people feel that, especially after Citizens United, that's exactly what it's become. And it's most people don't understand that difference, the difference between the private and the public, and unclear how it's going to play out.
Robert, I'm actually looking at a piece you had today in The Intercept. Was this the strangest weekend in American political history? In part what we've been talking about, but also you talk about Hillary Clinton and her very, I have to say, kind of strange comments about Nancy and Ronald Reagan and AIDS. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, yes. I mean, it's one of the odder aspects of the campaign at the moment that there's a widespread view that essentially this is a prologue to a direct race between Trump and Hillary Clinton. And you would think that when Trump is getting a fair amount of very negative coverage and his unfavorability numbers in the country generally are going up, even as he gets his base riled up, that Hillary Clinton would be in a fairly comfortable position. But she seems to be making a series of unforced errors. And one of them on Friday was she was attending the funeral of Nancy Reagan, and in her role as a former first lady herself. And she said something really head-scratching, which is to say that Nancy Reagan and President Reagan, who were very widely criticized for being silent about the AIDS epidemic at the time in the 80s for years, was a leading advocate for starting a national conversation about the crisis. She had to retract those comments within a couple of hours and apologize and say that she'd been thinking of Nancy Reagan's advocacy for stem cell research and a cure for Alzheimer's. It's a very odd and puzzling mistake for someone to make who was, you know, an adult and active in politics at the time. The only thing that I could guess is that there's a way in which it's somewhat uncomfortable and difficult for Hillary Clinton to both use her time as a first lady when she lived in the White House and had some role and some influence over policy, and to sort of not be tied to all of her husband's policies, which, of course, recently has been a problem since Bill Clinton was very much in favor of the free trade agreements that are unpopular in Rust Belt states and that Bernie Sanders opposed. But it's quite unusual. And it's another instance also where internet pressure now makes it incredibly quick that mistakes are identified and candidates are put on the back foot and forced to apologize. That all happened within the course of just a couple of hours.
And I guess and what's interesting and sort of what we've been talking about this hour is what has dominated the coverage are these confrontations at Donald Trump rallies, Robert.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's there's a way in which, too, you know, there have been protesters at other rallies. Bernie Sanders got a lot of credit from his supporters for allowing Black Lives Matter activists to take the mic and state their point of view earlier in the campaign. And recently, someone who is upset, another person who protests with Black Lives Matter, although it's not officially part of the group, raised comments that Hillary Clinton made during the 90s at a private fundraiser that she'd paid for a ticket to attend. So there is an interesting way in which I think the predominantly younger protesters from Black Lives Matter, inspired, I think, by the Occupy movement, are not actually sure that electoral politics should just be allowed to go along the old way, and they'll just make their voices heard at the ballot box. They actually want to take direct action and make their voices heard during the campaign.
And Heather, it's interesting that there, at least as it applies to Donald Trump, it doesn't seem to be say anything that can discredit him, that negative coverage isn't a negative for him. Do you think it says something about him, about the people who support his candidacy?
Well, absolutely I do. And it's interesting the comparison between Senator Sanders and Donald Trump in what Robert was just saying. That, and I think this ties right into the protests. One of the things that Donald Trump has made fun of Sanders for is letting those Black Lives Matter people take the mic. And one of the things that Trump does in playing into this idea that he's going to take the country back, that there are these people who are threatening the American government, who are taking tax dollars, who are the takers and not the makers, is that he is positioning himself as the biggest gorilla, if you will, on the playground. He's a bully. He's strong. He's going to make America what movement conservatives have promised it's going to be. Religious. I mean, one of the reasons I think that evangelicals fall behind him, even though it's hard to find a less religious character, that is the idea that he's going to be the strong man. He's the guy we can follow, and he's the guy who's going to get it done just by the force of his personality. And one of the ways he reinforces the idea that he has this strong leadership, masculine figurehead status is by threatening to hit people, threatening to get people behind him, saying, you know, beat somebody up because we're going to make this happen. And he's reinforcing his role as the dominant figure in the room. And that doesn't play well against, or it doesn't play well for somebody like Sanders, who has a very different leadership style.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and get some callers in on the conversation as well. That's Heather Cox Richardson, a Boston College history professor, author of a book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party, and Robert Mackey. He's a senior writer at the online publication The Intercept. And we got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the attacks, the fights, the heated arguments at rallies held by Donald Trump recently. Protesters have complained about being kicked and pushed, spat on and punched, while supporters complain their candidate is prevented from speaking. And Trump has been criticized inside and outside the GOP for using incendiary language. And again, our guests are Robert Mackey and Heather Cox Richardson. Let me get James from Princeton to join our conversation. And James, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure, go ahead.
I was just wondering, you know, Trump's kind of being accused of using mix to vilify the opponent. Yet on the air, he's been compared on this episode to George Wallace and Jefferson Davis, which I find gimmick of the left, which would, you know, be a rather transparent gimmick, actually. And just wanted, you know, to wonder if that comment would be clarified, you know, as far
sure.
as
well,
George Wallace and Jefferson Davis.
How do you see him? I'm curious, James.
I'm not a Trump supporter, but I find it conversations of the right kind of using tactics to vilify the opponent and that being only the bastion of right, you know, to be ironic when, you know, the guests on the show are no one's questioning comparisons to Jefferson Davis and George Wallace. It's like, let's throw Beelzebub in there, too, while we're at
it. Well, we didn't go quite that far, but no, I appreciate the call. And let me give Heather Cox Richardson a chance to respond to your comment. James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Heather, can you expand on that some?
Yeah, and I want to point out that we are actually talking about the violence side of the Trump campaign, which does, in fact, I think, speak to the language that he is using and where that goes. And I actually think under those circumstances, what I was trying to say with Jefferson Davis is that he wrote a narrative that then he had no choice but then to go forward and fire on there's a long story behind that, on fire on Fort Sumter. But George Wallace, of course, did a very similar thing, but George Wallace was mostly, I think, personally up to his own personal racism. I actually don't think Donald Trump is a politician. I think he's a salesman. And I think he's riding what a certain group of people have been hearing from American politicians on the right for 30 years now, and that's the idea that their country is in trouble and that it needs to be taken back from minorities, from women, from immigrants, from people who want a handout. But James, I think, is very right in that there is another side to Trump as well that doesn't speak to the violence, and that is that he is sort of the magical moment at which a demographic in America has realize that it's been sold a bill of goods, that narrative that in fact blames people of color, immigrants, women, people taking handouts, is a very effective way to whip people up. But they have done so with that. Movement conservatives have done so with that for 30 years. But the other side of what Trump is doing is speaking to those people and saying, but that's not actually all that's going on. Mm. The people who've been telling you that are the establishment Republicans who have rigged the system so that you've actually been losing economic ground now since 1980. And that's the side that, you know, I don't think that's so much the side behind the protest as the other, and we are talking about protests. But James makes a very good point that Trump is not at all a cartoon character, and I think it's a real mistake to look at him that way because he does speak to the interesting snapshot moment when American politics changes, because the story of America that politicians have been spinning for a generation, it's evident that that narrative no longer lines up with reality, and right now the voters see that, and Trump is the man who is articulating it.
Robert, do you want to weigh in on that as well? And I think also as Heather was describing some of the supporters for Trump, I think they do share some of the same concerns and criticisms about the system and how it's rigged and the fact that, you know, there's this divide between rich and poor, something that Bernie Sanders talks about with a great deal of passion.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to mention the Sanders campaign as well. I mean, it's obviously the case that you see an interesting parallel. It seemed to have started a little earlier in Europe, actually, where you see that as the left and right parties, the dominant parties, move to the center in search of the same votes, and there's a sort of consensus about the way that the economy is run, that it's fine as it is, and it's, you know, there's a obvious disconnect with the idea that we're creating a society where everyone has a fair shake and we're lifting up the middle class, which, you know, has been part of the rhetoric for decades, but obviously clashes with what people experience in everyday life, which is that wages are stagnant and that things are difficult for people. And this goes across both left and right, and it goes across the racial divides in America as well. And I think that we've seen now for years in Europe the rise of nationalist anti-immigrant popular parties, basically channeling not just racial resentment or class resentment, but this kind of idea that no one's representing us and we're getting completely, you know, taken advantage of economically. You know, we just saw in Germany a new party that's fairly far right dominate local elections just the other day. And it's something that's been happening for quite a while in Europe.
There's a tweet from Nate I want to toss back to you, Robert. He says, can't help but wonder if some of the protests are motivated by someone looking to jump in on the reality star fame and go viral. I mean, certainly the you mentioned Twitter, but the Internet has played such a big role in this campaign, not just with Donald Trump, but with other candidates as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there's one aspect that's obvious that journalists are tuned into and noticed right away, which is that, as I was saying with Hillary Clinton's comments about AIDS the other day and some other things, there's a kind of social fact-checking by the crowd that's phenomenal and actually very helpful in terms of correcting mistakes. But there's another aspect, which is that there's a way in which, you know, when Donald Trump was confronted on Meet the Press on Sunday with the fact that he had shared a fake hoax video of a man who tried to rush the stage in Dayton on Saturday, somebody who doesn't like this guy put up real video of him and superimposed ISIS music and a Photoshop of him holding a gun in front of an ISIS flag. And Donald Trump just asserted his fact that he has ties to ISIS. And when Chuck Todd told him that that's not actually true, Trump responded, well, you know, essentially, all I know is what's on the Internet. Mm. And there's a way in which his campaign is feeding these kind of fringe conspiracy theories and narratives that you find in usually unpublicized corners of the Internet, and making that actually part of his campaign, which helps draw certain kinds of voters to him, but obviously is worrying in other ways.
Heather, this always happens when we talk about Donald Trump. People are complaining that we're talking about Donald Trump. Someone has a question here. You know, what if he had a campaign rally and there were protesters and no one covered it, which is an interesting thing to contemplate. And I heard coming up later on another NPR program that they're going to be talking about how to cover Donald Trump, the challenges of covering someone like this. And you're a historian, but I'd be curious about if we should wrestle with this at all.
Well, it's a real problem because the Fourth Estate theoretically is supposed to keep us all informed. But when Robert was talking earlier, it made me think of Joe McCarthy. And when people were covering Joe McCarthy in the 1950s and his crusade against communism, which of course was virtually entirely made up in his head for attention, many people pushed back and said, stop giving this man oxygen, to which the press replied, privately they were beside themselves because they knew he was lying. But since the beginning of the 20th century, our press is supposed to cover news, and we're supposed to make good decisions about what they cover. And they're supposed to cover anything that's newsworthy. So how do you not cover somebody like Donald Trump? And believe me, I see the temptation. And you know, it's one of those things, if the tree falls in the forest and no one's there, does it make a sound? You wish you could silence Trump. But I think that Robert is right. With the social media the way it is, with the Internet the way it is, and with the role of the press being what it is in America, we must cover it. I would say, though, that it is important for people who are not simply reporters, I think, who are op-ed people, who are writing their own blogs, who are working in the Internet media, to call this for what it is. You know, the idea that we're too politically correct to that Trump says we're too politically correct to actually fight, I actually think you can fight with words, and you can point out the similarities between what is going on right now and other periods that have not ended well. And not only can we, I think that those of us who know those things have a responsibility to, so that people are informed about it.
What do you think, Robert? Then we'll get back to our callers.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, that's part of what we try to do at The Intercept. My colleague Lee Fang had an excellent piece pointing out that the head of CBS was privately telling investors and you know, people on their board that Trump, whatever you thought of him politically, was just great for ratings. And that this is the kind of thing that we can't necessarily just leave up to the traditional way the news media has covered things, which is to try to be even-handed, obviously out of a concern for being fair. But it does swarm to things that grab a lot of attention.
But, I mean, it seems the role of the press is also to fact-check things and to hold people's statements up to some kind of scrutiny. Robert, you want to just jump in on that, and then we'll get Dorsey on.
Well, yeah, but the difficulty is, in this case, you know, I forget what the current statistic is, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago that PolitiFact, the independent fact-checking organization, had checked, I think something like, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say, they checked 76 of Donald Trump's statements and found 75 of them to be at least partially false. And it doesn't seem to have made any difference to his campaign. You know, there's a way now that people have a lot of distrust of what they hear from the media. They've been told for a long time that it's all rigged. And it's difficult when someone is willing to just completely veer away from the facts and reality to hold someone like that accountable and have it make any difference.
Let me get Dorsey from Newcastle, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Sure.
I find this all really disturbing, this whole election cycle, because what he's doing is unleashing the beast in people. And we saw it in Bosnia when perfectly normal people, perfectly normal seeming Serbs, suddenly turned into people who tortured and murdered. This happened, I know Nazi Germany has been mentioned too often, but it, you know, it's something that happens. There are people who seem perfectly normal, and under normal circumstances, they're okay. And then they get a taste of the wrong kind of power. And I find this so frightening.
Well, Dorsey, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Robert, you covered Bosnia, did you not?
That's right. Well, actually, I worked for the United Nations on a television program during the war in the wars in Bosnia and Croatia.
Do you share Dorsey's concerns?
Yeah, actually, I didn't want to be hyperbolic, but I thought of that earlier, actually, as Heather was mentioning, people turning again. You know, there's this way in which people, Americans at every level, live together, and it's part of our almost unique ethos that people from everywhere form one country. And you see that. I heard so much rhetoric when I was in I heard from people who were refugees in Bosnia and Croatia and Serbia at the time, that they had lived together and everything was fine, and then people who they just, you know, thought of as neighbors and friends turned on them. Mm-hmm. And there is something very obviously deeply ugly in nationalism. There's a reason the word, you know, the German word for national is embedded in Nazi. And there's something dangerous when you start with a country like ours where people are from everywhere. You start to say that we're, you know, under threat from these other foreigners who are not legitimate Americans. And, of course, Trump started himself plumbing those kind of depths with his whole crazy conspiracy theory about President Obama not having been born in the United States, which was sort of the foundation of his run.
Let me get Dan from looks like Fishtown to join our conversation. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So, to my mind, Donald Trump just seems like the most famous dunk tank clown at the carnival. He says whatever he wants. He says incendiary comments to get people to gather around. Some people laugh. Some people even pay to throw balls at him. And sometimes they do knock him down. But he just gets right back up on his perch, keeps saying whatever he wants.
So it's entertainment, Dan? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, he's an entertainer. He's a game show host. I think it's fairly obvious.
Well, Heather, you call him a salesman. Dan says he's one of those guys at the dunk tank at the carnival. You want to respond to Dan's comment?
Yes, and I think that this actually goes back to what I was saying at the very beginning about Jefferson Davis, which, again, the parallels that I'm trying to make there are between a leader and his followers. And that's that, yeah, he's in many ways laughable. He is a cartoon character in some ways. He's a brilliant speaker. That's very important to remember. He actually backloads his sentences so that the strong word is the last one in the sentence, and what that does is it appeals to people's emotions. And what frightens me in the way that he is operating is that, you know, whatever you think of the man, and I actually think he's a shapeshifter. He's a salesman. He is simply selling his own popularity. The problem is he is giving a number of disaffected people a language for their anger and displacement in the modern world. And once that gets loose, it's going to be very hard to stop. And interestingly enough, one of the people who was very concerned about this happening in America all those years ago was Dwight Eisenhower. Mm. Dwight Eisenhower fell in love with a book called True Believer by Eric Hoffer, who was a philosopher in California, in which he looked at the way that mass movements were organized around either a major religious figure or some kind of person on the far left or the far right. And what he said is that the leader doesn't really matter. Everybody focuses on the leader at the end of the day, but what you really need to look at is how, for a generation, a population that will follow a leader gets made. And that, I think, is what we're looking at. We've got a population that's been constructed over the last generation to believe that America and their place in it is under threat by lazy women, minorities, immigrants who are threatening the very foundation of what America stands for. And once those people get the idea that they must take America back, they must take their country back, and that will restore them to cultural significance and economic significance again, once you've let that loose, that's going to be a really, really hard thing to pull back in without it not going in a good direction.
Robert, we're almost out of time. How do you think this ends then?
I mean, it seems, it's like predicting the weather, trying to predict politics, and this year it's like politics during the era of climate change. It's hard to say, but it does seem I would expect that Trump will get the nomination. I would also expect that he'll lose by quite a lot.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Robert Mackey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Senior writer at the online publication The Intercept, Heather Cox Richardson, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
History professor at Boston College, wrote a new history of the Republican Party to make men free. And we began our conversation with Ashley Parker. She's a New York Times reporter, has been covering some of the Donald Trump rallies. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.